speak now.
Thank you, Kathy, for that warm introduction. My name is Kay Cornwell. I'm an alcoholic. I'll just speak. Can you hear me? Can you hear me okay? Do I need to move? Okay. Well, I was really glad to hear there were only 704 people here. People have been quoting 900 and 1,000 to me. I was nervous until I heard 704, and I thought, well, I don't have to worry about anything. It's not as big as they say. Well, I am a little nervous, you know, so you guys are just going to have to love me through this, you know. I've heard here that a talk from the heart reaches the heart, and that's what I'm going to try to do tonight is talk to you from my heart because, you know, I've talked a lot this weekend to people here about AA being a program of attraction, and that was what attracted me to this program, people's hearts, what were in their hearts. So I'm going to begin by sharing with you a little bit, you know, about what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I'm going to warn you, I'm a low bottom drug, so if there's any of those here, you'll recognize me. And you know, I thought I'd be coming up here and not know anybody and not feel safe, but I look out and, you know, I've seen quite a few people here already this weekend that I know, people that love me, and that makes me feel better. Like I said, I'm a little scared, so I see the ones out there that love me, so y'all, let me know that, let me feel that from you. Yeah, I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come, and I'd like to thank Kathy for being my hostess, but most of all, Buck, thank you. Buck's my hero. He's one of my mentors in this program and has been since I got here, him in Virginia. And big thanks to you, Buck. I was born in Gaston County, North Carolina. I think Mike mentioned it last night. I mean, it was high school, Gastonia. I thought, gee, I feel like I'm at home. So I was born in Belmont. That's on the eastern end of the county. And Belmont, Gaston County is a textile county. I don't know if you know up here much about textiles, cotton mills, but that's all Gaston County had when I was growing up was cotton mills. You know, the little town I lived in probably had a population of 30,000. I doubt if it was that much, but they had like 15 or 20 factories that were cotton mills, you know, and that's all that was there. And these plants had little villages. They built houses so the people that worked there could live in the villages and have communities. And I grew up in those communities and loved it. You know, I didn't see anything wrong with my childhood at all. We were extremely poor, but that didn't bother me because the whole town was poor. There was no peer pressure. Everybody had the same thing you had. You know, you played together, got along good together. You know, my parents didn't get along too great. They fought a lot and later ended up splitting up. I don't remember any alcohol in my home when I was younger. I have a brother that's older than me, and I have three younger sisters. I was the oldest girl. And because I was the oldest girl, when my parents split up, I guess I was 9 or 10 years old, I took over most of the responsibilities of the household. Now, this was a lot of responsibility. It was grocery shopping, cooking, cleaning, watching the kids, you know, whatever it took to help my mother. And I guess I remember my first resentment about this time because what happened was this mill village, this plant, they told my mother she could still be employed there, but because she was single, this was early 60s, and she was a divorcee, you know, that wasn't good for the community, but she said she would have to move, you know. So we did, we moved, and she quit the job, too. She didn't work for them either. My mother started drinking about this time, and she went to work in a bar, and we moved to a little trailer park in a town called Mount Holly. I didn't think about that trailer park for so many years, and then I heard my sister Jan, who's also in this program, she described it. She said, we moved to a drunk trailer park, and that's what we did, you know. It was one of those, it was a real trailer park, you know, the kind you see on the Jerry Springer show sometimes if you don't watch that. So, you know, the next few years of my life, my mother, she was being gone a lot. She was drinking more, and she was working in bars. She'd get up and leave in the morning, and she would come home after the bars closed. So we didn't see her very much, but that gave me total authority and responsibility for the house and for my younger sisters. So, well, the first thing I did was quit going to school, you know. I'd just write my own notes to excuse me from school, and I'd stay at home. If the truant officer came, I'd be at home. They weren't too strict back then, so... things at our house started getting pretty bad. My mother's drinking escalated, and by her own admission, she is an alcoholic, and she had gotten into alcoholic drinking, and her home began to split up. I became very resentful. I wanted to get away from home. You know, I knew I was smarter than everybody else in that family, and I knew they weren't living like they should, and that there was a better world out there, and I just wanted to go out there and show everybody how to do it the right way. I knew I could. I was 12 years old, after all, you know. I did end up leaving home really early. I left home when I was 14. I was in eighth grade. I quit school and got married and set out to show the world how intelligent and how smart I was. Like Mike, of course. Anyway, you know, I did. I got married when I was 14, and I swore by this time I was having a lot of resentment at my mother, and I swore that I would never be like her. I would never drink, and I would never do the things she had done. I was very angry. And I wanted her to know that, you know, that I was okay and I could do it, you know, all the things that she didn't do for us, I wanted to do for my family, for my kids, you know. And I started having kids right away. That's, again, because I was smart. I had four when I was 19, you know. And, you know, life wasn't really good. I 14 years old, I was a child myself. I didn't know anything about raising kids, about being married, being a wife. I had no role model to know how wives and mothers did, and still determined not to drink. Things went bad in that marriage, and we ended up divorcing when I was 20 years old. I took my first drink of alcohol when I was 21. I was a late bloomer, but I bloomed real fast. You know, by this time I had gone to court and had my children placed in foster homes. I had no home for them, nowhere to keep them, and I thought that was the best thing that I could do for them. And to be honest, too, a little bit of me had so much responsibility all my life. I was getting tired of that, and I wanted to have some fun. I didn't know what having fun was, and I wanted to do that, too. And I really just didn't know what to do with those children. So I went to court, and I had them placed and asked the judge to place them in foster homes. And he did, and he also gave me a lecture while I was there and told me, you know, that if I couldn't raise those children, that he had a family that would like to adopt them and raise all four of them. And I promised him I'd think about that, you know, and I left. And later I did. I went back and had gave up parental rights and had those children were adopted by a family that raised all four of them and kept them together through the years. This is what I said about drinking. You know, the day I left the courthouse, I think I took my first drink. I was hitchhiking home. You know, I was 21 years old, didn't have a driver's license yet. I was hitchhiking home, and a guy picked me up, and he had an 8-pack of Pony Millers in the front seat with him. And he asked me if I'd like one, and of course I said yes. And, you know, okay, so now I've got no responsibility. So I drank two of those Pony Millers, and I remember feeling like, you know, it's like Mike said last night. You know, I was ready to get started. And the next morning I got up and I wanted to have fun and I wanted to party and I wanted to do all the things I heard hear other people talking about doing. There was a lot of, you know, my mother was consistent if nothing else. You know, all four of my siblings, we all drank alcoholically. We all wanted to become alcoholics. So there was some consistency there. And they were having a good time and they were telling me all about these parties and going out and getting drunk and having a good time doing all these things, you know. And I didn't know how, but I wanted to do that. So, I knew my mother, I could find her at one of those illegal clubs that Mike mentioned last night in his talk, you know, except we called them the bootleggers. And I knew that's where she'd be, so I got up on a Thursday morning, you know, that was the next day after those two Pony Millers, and I walked about 7 miles over to that bootleggers. It was in Lowell. Now, bootleggers, I know that brings to mind thoughts of white liquor, but it's not. Gaston County was dry. There was nowhere to drink on premises or even off premises. They didn't sell alcohol. So every community would have a house. Household, you know, every town would have a house that somebody would open up, and this particular place was on the end of a dirt road, and they had even taken the doors off the hinges. You know, there's no doors hanging, it's just completely open. 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, they sold alcohol and they sold liquor. They sold beer and liquor, and people came and they stayed as long as they wanted to, and it was just a place for people and for all the drunks to go drink, you know, hang out together. I remember I walked up the railroad tracks that day. There was a tracks that run by it, and it was a shortcut. So I walked off the tracks, and I was 21 years old, and I looked over in the yard, and there was this big oak tree out there, and it was in the fall. It was drizzling rain, and there was about 8 people out in the yard there, dirt yard, and they were picking guitars, and they were drinking, and they looked like they were just having a real blast, you know. I even remember what they were playing. The guy that was picking the guitar was picking Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, you know. And I was kind of feeling sorry for myself along about then, and I thought, you know, I had arrived. I thought that was right where I needed to be. So I walked up, you know, and Nobody questioned who I was. They just asked me what I wanted to drink. They knew that was my mother sitting there, so they thought she's okay, so I got to be okay. So they asked me what I wanted to drink. I asked them what they had, and they told me they had Budweiser, Miller. They had Canadian Mist in half-pint bottles, and they had vodka in half-pint bottles. Now, that brand of vodka was called Haven and Hill vodka. That's probably about as cheap as you could get, you know. After that day, I started calling it Heaven and Hell vodka, and still do, you know. Well, I looked at my mom and remember I never wanted to be like her, and she was drinking Canadian Mist, so I ordered vodka. I ordered a half pint of vodka. And I didn't want anybody to know that I didn't know how to drink. So I just, I really didn't know how to drink. So I opened the cap and I turned the half pint up intending to kill it. And I don't know if I drank it all or not. I don't remember anything else after that point. All I remember is taking the cap off that bottle and turning it up. I remember waking up the next morning on a little cot in that bootlegger's and sick, not remembering anything that had happened, and I looked over beside me, and there's this old wino beside me, you know, this old man. I found out later he'd carried me to bed and kind of watched out, felt sorry for me, and watched out for me through the night so that nobody would bother me, nothing would happen to me, you know. And I looked up, and there he was, and I'm sick anyway, and he looked at me, and he said, "What made you sick will make you well." So he bought me another half pint of that stuff, you know. But he told me I was going to have to learn how to drink a little better than I did the night before. You know, this man became very important to me. His name was Doughbelly. He was a wino. You know, he lived there. He lived there and he bummed. And he kind of took me under his wing, and I kind of lived there and bummed with him for a while. And he taught me a lot of good things about living out on the street and living in that lifestyle. You know, mostly he taught me to stay away from drugs. He told me I could always stand on the street corner and bum enough money to get me something to drink. But I'd have to do other things if I got involved with the drugs. So he put a fear in that for me right away. He was a wino, you know, he was my hero. I wanted to be just like him. It didn't matter if he was the only person there at that bootlegger's. We had a pool table, you know, and a jukebox and all this, you know, it's just like a bar. And if he was the only person there, the jukebox was going wide open and you were having a good time, and he could bum money really easy, you know, he could bum drinks. So I hung out with him for a lot of years, and he became the father, you know, that I didn't have. I grew to love him. That's how my life went for the next few years. You know, I had no responsibility. I did what I wanted to. I drank every day. You know, I worked in bars if I worked at all. I lived off the streets and did what I wanted. And life was fun. I loved it. I loved doing that for a long time. And alcohol was my best friend. It helped me to survive in a time in my life when I don't think I would have survived otherwise. And, you know, but it did begin to turn on me. Things happened. You know, I started, you know, not feeling as good, not as good as always. And I met a man too, this Doughbelly. His son got out of federal penitentiary one day, and he came by the bootleggers, and then so we moved in together the next day. Well, I was already living with this dad, you know. We ended up getting married years later. We lived together a few years, and he drank like I did, you know, but we learned right away. I learned to drink slow if he was drinking heavy, and he learned to drink slow if I was really drinking a lot, because you know, that's just the way it was at our house. It was, you know, it was just real volatile. It was either really good or really bad. And our relationship, you know, the more we drank, the worse the relationship got. So I remember telling him one day that I thought we needed to get married, that would help us to get along better. You know, we did. We got married. And this is my story, not his. You know, I'm up here to tell you what happened to me. We got married, but things didn't get any better. Of course, you know that. You've been there. You know, you find all kind of fixes for yourself. None of them work. My drinking got worse. You know, I went to work for him. He was a painting contractor, and I worked for him. I was a house painter for about 10 years, and he was a great enabler also. I went to work drunk if I wanted to. I didn't go to work if I didn't want to. He paid me anyway. It didn't matter. Whatever. He was a great enabler. I was one of those traveling drunks, though. When I got paid on Friday, when he paid me, I was gone. I was out of there. I came back when I was broke. You know, and he was always glad to see me come back. I could never understand that. You know, I always came home thinking, oh, this is really going to be it. But no, he was always glad that I just came home at all. you know, and my drinking's getting worse. I'm starting to get sick, and I'm starting to get in a lot of trouble. You know, I'm getting in fights. I'm doing all the things I never thought I would do. You know, all those things that she did. I've gone beyond that now. I'm doing things that even my mother wouldn't do. Okay? What happened? You know, well, I told you that. First, let me say that this father-in-law of mine, this wino, Dobelli, he was out on the road and ended up in Florida somewhere, and he found AA, or AA found him, I don't know. He came back, and he became an active member in Alcoholics Anonymous in Gaston County. And he thought, I guess, you know, since he had taught me all about how to drink, he needed to teach me how to get sober. Now, he was one of those, he preached AA at me for quite a few years, you know. He loved AA, and he preached it to me for quite a few years. But, of course, you know, I didn't have a problem. I'm going to tell you, I thought my problem was mental. Alcohol was, my problem was that I was just crazy. And I really believe that. As I said, I started getting in trouble with my drinking, and I had a little sister. I have a younger sister. I told you all my siblings are alcoholics too. I have a younger sister, and she was starting to get in a lot of trouble drinking and doing the things she was doing. And so the things that Doug Ellie would come and tell me about AA, I would share with my sister, my younger sister, you know, because she was really sick and she needed help. And it sounded like this is what she needed. And I could see the changes in Doug Ellie too. I saw the changes take, the program of attraction. That's what you're attracted to, the changes that take place inside a person when they get in these rooms and get better. And I saw those changes in Dobelli. So I would take what he shared with me, and I would share it with my sister. And as a result, she ended up going into a detox and going to Black Mountain and getting sober. Jan P. from Charlotte, many of you know her, and she's spoken at this conference too, I understand, a few years back. She got sober. She likes to tell everybody that I 12-stepped her drunk, you know. This program tells me you got to give it away in order to keep it. You know, I had to give it away even to get here, you know. And I tease her a lot. I say she was the real sick one. But, you know, I know better than that. I know who the sick one really is. She got an AA. And when she was sober a year, she asked me to come and hear her speak at her first talk. And I did. I was very proud of her. I saw a lot of changes take place in her immediately, you know. She started getting a little honest. Started showing a little responsibility. But most of all, you know, I would call her up because I'm a big sister. You know, she's the baby. And all my life, I've kind of like had to look after her. So I'm still calling her up. I'm drunk. I'm calling her up every time I get drunk to kind of give her some advice on her life still and tell her what she needs to do. And she let me do that. She didn't say anything. You know, she didn't say, call me back when you're sober. She just let me talk all I wanted to. And then at the end of the, before she hung up the phone, she would get something in there about AA. And I guess it kind of stuck. I went to hear her speak, and for some reason, I identified with her at that meeting. I identified with alcoholism. I knew that alcohol was a problem for me, so I picked up a white chip. It was on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock meeting, and when I left that meeting, I thought, you know, I got real smart again, see, and this happens to me. I thought, well, gee, if alcohol is a problem, all I have to do is quit drinking. I don't need all this, so I threw the white chip out the window, you know. Went to see my doctor the next day, and Gaston County has a lot of doctors that don't mind helping you with your nerves if you got bad nerves. A lot of people in Gaston County got bad nerves. And if you got real bad nerves, you know which doctor to go see. And I did. So I went to see this physician and told him that I thought, you know, that I was an alcoholic and I wanted to quit drinking, but I was worried about my nerves. But he was glad to help me out with that and give me some tranquilizers that would help that problem. And I know this is an AA talk, but this is part of my story. So I was determined I was going to quit drinking, okay? So I started taking tranquilizers, and he gave me a major tranquilizer with a lot of refills. And in just about 6 weeks' time, those were all gone. And I was like lost, you know? I was in a blackout all the time. And I did have blackout drinking right from the start, but the tranquilizers were worse. So they ran out, and I didn't know that you couldn't just stop taking tranquilizers. I didn't know that. I thought they're gone. Okay, so my nerves should be better now. Everything should be fine. You know, that's my perception of things, right? So I quit taking them, and a couple days later, I ended up in the emergency room with a grand mal seizure, and they asked me there, had I been taking any drugs, and I can rationalize, too. You know, God has intelligence, and it helps me to rationalize things away, and my thought was I hadn't had anything in 2.5 days, so no, I'm not taking anything, you know. They knew better. They didn't ask me to follow up on. They didn't send me to a doctor for the seizure activity or anything. They just sent me home. And okay, so here I am. Now I've got no tranquilizers, and I don't want to drink. I know I've got a problem with alcohol. I've admitted that. Okay, so what am I going to do now? Well, that got really hard, and I found out that I couldn't quit drinking. And I'd gone through years of, you know, doing the thing, slowing down, knowing alcohol. You know, I'd gone through that for the last several years, and but I finally admitted I did have a problem with alcohol, and I wanted to quit. But you know what? You know what? I couldn't do it. What I started doing was going camping on weekends, okay? Now, I'm still married to this active alcoholic. Everybody I know still drinks just like me or worse, you know, and I started going camping on weekends, and I would go camping. Every weekend, my husband would take me camping, and I would take with me a case of beer and a fifth of vodka and a fifth of peppermint schnapps, and I would be worried about running out of that, you know, before I got home. And we left on Saturday morning, and we come back on Sunday night. Now, and what I did, I would go off and I would get drunk on these camping trips, and then I would come home and pretend like I hadn't had anything to drink. I don't know who I was pretending that to, you know. I was lying to me. It's the denial of this disease. And this went on for a few weeks, and I was getting really sick, and I was getting really depressed, and I knew I couldn't quit drinking, and the morning drink didn't work anymore. What happened? We had a big party one night, and I got up on Monday morning. It was one weekend, and parties, we'd started having a lot of parties at our house because I was getting in trouble every time I went out, you know. So I'd learned to stay at home. One weekend in particular, I left on Friday morning when I got paid, Friday afternoon, and I started home sometime on Sunday night when I was broke. I don't know, but I didn't want to go home. For some reason, I knew there was going to be a big fight at my house when I got home, so apparently I didn't want to go home. I really don't know what I was thinking, what made me, you know. I was just in an alcoholic blackout. I drove myself to the local police department and demanded to be locked up for DWI. Well, there was nothing in the procedure manual for that. They knew that I would not get enough help at the jailhouse, and I needed more expensive help than that. You know, they tried to talk to me. They called my sister and had her to come up there, and wanted her to take me home. I refused to leave. I got in the car, drove around the block a couple times, pulled back in, and so they told me, yeah, you're right, we're going to take you to jail. They called a county rural down to the police station, and he put me in the front seat of a pickup and started up the road with me. And I said something about going to jail. Now, a lot of this, I can remember bits and pieces. Later, some of it was told to me. I know I said something about going to jail, and he informed me that he wasn't taking me to jail. He was going to take me to detox. Well, now, I wanted to go to jail. You know, I was alcoholic, so we know what we need, right? I didn't want to go to detox, so I opened the door and jumped out of the patrol car at 25 miles an hour. And that upset him, and he told me, he got out, he handcuffed me, and he said, yeah, you're going to jail. Yeah, so he did lock me up for drunk and disorderly. And my brother-in-law picked me up the next morning. He had a six-pack of Bud for me when he came and got me out of jail. He knew I was going to need it. But that was, you know, that's the things that happened when I left home now, so I'd learned to stay at home. And bad things happen at home, too, don't get me wrong. But on this particular weekend, you know, we'd partied all weekend, and I was sick on Monday morning, and I had some schnapps there, and I had some, not schnapps for the morning drink, no, peppermint schnapps, no, but I had some vodka, and that didn't help, you know. The morning drink didn't make me feel any better. So, you know, I looked in the mirror, and you know who I saw? I saw that mother I said I was never going to be like. So I asked my husband, you know, and this was, I don't know, it's a big deal for me. I don't know what was going on with me, but I asked him to go to the ABC store, the Red Dot store, and get me some Canadian Mist, you know, because I'd realized I was just like her. And he did. He went and got me a pint of Canadian Mist, brought it back, drank some of that, and I was able to keep it down. It helped the hangover, and I thought, maybe I should have done this years ago. It's a lot smoother than that vodka, you know. But anyway, you know, I made up my mind that morning that I was just going to drink myself to death. I was in that place, that jumping off place, and I didn't know it. Didn't have enough sense to know it. What happened was that, you know, I think he recognized that. I don't know what happened. God intervened in my life. My husband came to me and he said, you know, I think I'm an alcoholic. I have a problem. I'm going to start going to AA. Would you go with me? Well, here was another sick person in my life that needed me. Okay. Well, of course I'll go with you to AA. You know, I'll be glad to. That gave me a cause, you know. So we came in together on the next night. That was Tuesday, December 20th, 1988. We came in together and picked up a white chip. And that's the last white chip I've had to pick up, by God's grace, here. After 28 days, he told me that he thought that he wasn't an alcoholic and he wanted to drink again. And he wondered how that was going to affect our relationship. You know, and I told him by that point, at 28 days, you know, this is where I need to be. This is where I'm going to stay. You know, and I'm worried more about how that's going to affect our relationship. because what I had found here in 28 days was just amazing. I found hope that my life could be better. So, you know, that was where I was at. All my life was hopeless. I'd look out and I'd see that people had a better life, but I didn't know how they got it. I certainly didn't know they worked hard to do it, that they were responsible and accountable and all that. I probably wouldn't have stayed had I known that's what it took. You guys let slip that in on me a little bit at a time, as much as I could take. But, you know, I found hope here that my life, too, could change. And I told them that I wanted to stay. And I'd made a commitment to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I did that, went beyond that. And the most amazing thing to me is that I started doing what you told me to do. Gosh, I'd stayed in trouble all these years because every time somebody told me to do something, oh, no, no. But I can hear you tell me to pick up ashtrays and I'll do it. You tell me to make coffee. Whatever you tell me to do, I do it. I don't know why. I did it. I just did it. You know, and that's God's grace. I was glad to be here. You know, I realized I was where I needed to be. I got a sponsor. I started working on the steps, doing everything that you told me to do, and cleaned up the outside. You know, I did the mechanical things that cleaned up the outside, and I started feeling a little bit better about myself, you know. And I will say, too, that very next night, Wednesday night, went to a meeting at the Scout Hut, which is my home group today, and our speaker that night was Buck Melton, and Buck went up to the podium, you know. And all my life, I had felt so much shame about who I was and the bars that my mom worked in and the bars I went to, because people would find that out and they'd say, oh, you know, what's a nice girl like you go to a place like that for? You know, and I thought, you don't know me. I'm not a nice girl. And I had a lot of shame. And Buck got up to the podium and he started talking about those same places, you know, but he wasn't ashamed. He didn't feel any shame, you know. And Buck touched my heart that night, you know. I kept coming back. And he had on a pair of red boots, too, that were really nice, I think. And I thought, there's a lot of things that attract you to this program. New cars, you know, all kind of stuff. Anyway, Buck did touch my heart that night. And that's the way it went for me. You know, I did everything I was supposed to do. When I was 3 months sober, I decided I didn't want to be a painter the rest of my life, so I better do something else. And I saw an ad in the paper that advertised GED at Gaston Community College, a local community college. So I went and signed up for that. Went through classroom lectures to get my GED, and only because the ad promised job placement, that they would help you find, you know, another job or whatever. And I was going to get something out of it. All my life I've been trying to get something out of whatever it was I was doing, okay? A little bit of honesty now. So I finished that program, that GED program there at Gaston College, and, you know, like I said, I'd quit in eighth grade to get married, and I always thought that I I'll talk about how I think I'm smart, you know, I can joke about the things that I think I am, but inside I knew I wasn't. You know, that last year in school, I was in a class for slow learners, and that stuck with me. I really thought I couldn't learn, you know, that you had something that I, you know, that just God favored you and gave you things that he didn't give me, you know. And what I began to find out in this program was that I had those things too. You know, they just had to be developed. Somebody had to tell me I had them, and they had to teach me what to do with them once I found out I had them. And so I did. I went to school, got my GED, graduated, and I'm going to say this, with the highest score that the GED department had had in 16 years. And I say that only because that's what the program had done for me, see. Well, I realized that last year in school, when I was in that class for slow learners, it was my attitude even then. It was the alcoholism, the isms. You know, I could have done it then. It was my attitude. But I had come into life with a new attitude when I came into this program. You know, and the people there, the people in AA talked to me and asked me to go on to school, think about going on to school, and I did. And I went to the community college there, got an Associate of Arts degree. Now, that was something I could do. Going to school was easy. It was getting out here and doing the other things that I need to do. That was hard for me. And, you know, I guess that was my milk. It just got me, you know, to a place where I could feel good and confident enough about myself to get out in the world. After 2 years in the GED program, Associate Arts program, I decided to enter the nursing program there at Gaston College. And again, because it had something to offer me, okay? It was close. I wouldn't have far to drive. And I felt like I could meet the requirements and graduate. And the job market was good. I'd never have to worry about a job. And the pay scale was better than most four-year degrees. So I just went to talk to the career counselors and decided on that and entered the nursing program there. And you know, the first thing that happened when I went into nursing school was I quit going to meetings, you know, because I didn't think that shame's still here. I'd cleaned up the outside, but the inside was still really dirty. I was still ashamed. And I knew if they found out who I was, that they wouldn't want me in their nursing program. They'd kick me out. So I stopped going to meetings because I was afraid somebody would find out. I didn't have to get drunk because they kept me really busy. It was a rough 2 years. After a year and a half, they had us to fill out an application for licensure in the state of North Carolina as a nurse, and I filled that out. Now, when I entered nursing school, I had to furnish them with a record, a criminal records check, and that was clear. There hadn't been anything on it in a while, so there was nothing that showed. But when I had to fill out this application for a license, there was a question on there that said, have you ever been arrested in the state of North Carolina? Check yes or no. Easy, huh? Yeah. It took me 4 weeks to check that box. Because I wanted to lie. I wanted to check no. But then I started finding out something about fear, and I realized what fear was. And then I realized that all my life I'd been terribly afraid. I just couldn't identify what it was. And the fear of checking that box, if I checked yes, what was going to happen. I wasn't worried so as much about the state of North Carolina as I was about Gaston College. I knew how tough they were. I knew they were going to kick me out. So, you know, I went up to the clerk of court in Gaston County and asked her to go back on the microfilm and get a complete records check, which she didn't want to do, but she did, and she gave that to me. And I also found out they still had a warrant active on me from 1976 that they served on me. So I had to clear that up. Yeah, and Jan talked to me a lot through this time. She helped me overcome some of those fears. And what I realized, I finally checked yes because I had something to offer me. Because if I checked no, I would have to spend the rest of my life with that same fear. And it was overwhelming, you know, so I just checked yes simply for the fact, let's get it over with now. I don't want to run from it the rest of my life. So I got that criminal records check and took it into the dean of nursing, and she threw a box of Kleenex on her desk when I came in. She knew something was up. She didn't know what. I showed it to her. All prepared to be kicked out, but she was wonderful, you know. She was great. She said, you haven't done anything I haven't done. I just didn't get caught. And she picked up the phone and she called the State Board of Nursing in North Carolina and gave me a personal recommendation. And she allowed me to send my license application in separate from the rest of the class so that nobody else would have to see that. She protected my anonymity. I learned a lot about walking through fear that day, you know, and that's really stuck with me. That helps me when I have to get up here in front of all you. I got to face my fears, you know. Fearing is the worst part for me. You know, I have nothing to be afraid of. It's the fear itself that's going to get me if I don't face it. Okay, so I graduated from nursing school, and I went to work as a nurse, and gosh, life is great, and life is, and all these wonderful things are happening, and I feel good about myself. And went to work at Cleveland Community Hospital and worked there for a year, and you know, I gotta back up and tell you some other things happened to me in sobriety too here. The good things that have happened to me since I've been, because I don't remember, there's some bad things that have happened to me in sobriety, but I don't remember those. I remember the good things. The first thing I did was start going to meetings again when I got out and graduated, because I found myself at Food Lion shopping for groceries one day. I hadn't been to a meeting in a year and a half, and I was shopping for groceries, and my buggy kind of just, a magnet drew it over to the wine aisle. Now, I like wine, too. I was one of those wine drinkers. And you know, I just came to myself standing there looking at that wine at the grocery store, and I'm thinking, okay, you better go to a meeting. Okay, so I did that same. The next day, I was back at the scout hut, and Josh ran into one of my buddies from the scout hut here, and he was there. I went in, and I called my sponsor first. She hadn't heard from me in a year and a half, and I knew what she was going to say. Okay, Shane's still here, but she didn't. She said, I love you. I'm glad to hear from you, and she still wanted to be my sponsor, and we began to work all over again on the steps, and things changed, okay? Now the inside is starting to clean up a little bit because of the fear. I'm able to walk through the fear and let you know who I am and be able to know who you are. Things began to get better on the inside. God had a lot of work to do. I'm 5 years sober now, and the inside's just now starting to get cleaned up. I was a sick person when I got here. Life got really good for me really fast, and it remains good today. I did go to work, like I said, as a nurse first on the floor for a year, and then I went to a nursing home and worked there for 2 years as a supervisor, and today I'm in the operating room. I'm working night shift at our community hospital. I work in the operating room, and I love that. My life has been full of chaos forever, it seems like, and I just kind of fit in with the chaos that goes on there at night, you know. And plus, I get to interact with an awful lot of drunks, you know. Some of the docs at work even tell me now I should be working up on the site floor. So if you do, have a drunk come in, like, okay, go talk to them. She knows how to talk to those drunks. Now, they don't know. At least I don't think they do. They probably do. But I get to interact with a lot of drunks, too, and do some work that way. When I was 9 months sober, I'm going to back up and tell you this, too. When I was 9 months sober and I'd graduated with my GED, you know, and started for the associate arts degree, I got a telephone call one day, and I picked the phone up, and there was a voice on the other end, and there was this young girl on the phone, and she said, "Can I speak to Kay Moore?" And I said, "You have the wrong number." And then I happened to remember that was my name for so many years, and I kept it listed in the phone book like that, and I thought, wait a minute, why do you want to speak to Kay Moore? Because I'm only 9 months over, and there could be a lot of people out there still looking for Kay Moore, okay? And this young boy says, "My name is Michelle, and I was adopted, and I'm looking for my mother." And I said, "Well, this is her, and you found her." So I was 9 months sober, and I got to go meet my oldest daughter. You know, she had turned 18 and had left at home. They were adopted by a family in South Carolina. All four of them lived together. They grew up together. And so I got to meet her that night, and probably 3 months later, I met my son, who was in the Job Corps at that time, 17. He left the Job Corps and lived with me, you know, and lived with me for a year and a half, and I had to tell him he had to leave. He had some problems. I had to tell him to leave, and that was hard, but it was what I had to do. It was the best thing. He tells me now when I'm having trouble with tough love, he'll say, "Remember tough love, Mom. It worked for me." And, you know, and then in the next year, I met the daughter next to him, and so they each left the nest. You know, they came to look me up, and you know, I have a relationship with all of them today. It's not always good. Sometimes it's great, but it's been a lot of hard work. They weren't very trusting, and I wasn't very trusting either. You know, I knew they only came back to pay me back, to hurt me. You know, and then I've had to go to them and say, "Hey, I'm responsible for what happened." But they turned out great in spite of everything, you know, and that's a blessing. I have 8 grandchildren today, you know. Never thought of that. It's great. It's great. It's wonderful. You know, things have gone on, and it just seems like everything in my life has just worked, has been God working for me to do the things that I couldn't do for myself, you know. That mother that I was so angry at, I have a good relationship with her today. I remember when I had to make an amends to her, and it took me a long time to make amends to my mom, because I kept saying, "What am I going to make amends to her for? She should be making amends to me, right?" Nah. You know, and it took a long time for me to get the concept of why I even needed to make amends to her. Not for anything, certainly, that I had done to her. I didn't know, you know, I wasn't saying, "I did this to you, I did that." What I'm saying is, "Mom, I'm sorry I was such a terrible daughter," because I harbored all those ill feelings and that resentment and hate towards her, you know. That's what I'm sorry for. And I realized that my mother had never done anything to hurt me. I had hurt myself by harboring all those feelings. It was me. I did that. I caused all that pain. It wasn't her. She doesn't have the power to hurt me. You don't have the power to hurt me. I have the power to turn anything you do into hurt by turning it into resentment and anger and mistrust. And I learned a valuable lesson there. And I've learned a lot of lessons here. Yeah, I remember when I was 9 months old, I was sitting in a Flynn home. You know, they have discussion meetings, and I used to go to a lot of those meetings at the Flynn home early in sobriety. And somebody read a thought for the day from the non-conference approved literature, okay? They read a thought for the day, November the 4th, and it said, you know, I'll never forget it. It was like a light bulb come on. Happiness is a byproduct of right living. Well, see, I told you that's how I wanted all my life. Didn't know how to get it because I didn't know what right living was. Didn't have anybody ever tell me or show me. Didn't want to know either. You know, that's the truth. I didn't want to know. But now I did. And I had you guys, see, and you were able to tell me what right living was. More than that, you were able to show me what right living was. It's a program of attraction. You showed me how to live right. And you made me want it, you know. And I see that I can have it too. See, God gives us all the same thing. He's giving us all the same thing. Everybody sitting here, He's giving it to us all. All we're going to do is just accept it and say thank you. You know, I met my father again after, gosh, I don't know how many years. He had walked off, you know, when I was like 10 and never came back. And I tried to establish a relationship with him a few times, and he wasn't very receptive to that. He was ashamed, too, of the things that had gone on. Well, he developed cancer, and he was in the hospital for 3 months, and his sister called me and told me that he had cancer and was in the hospital. He didn't want us to know. You know, he didn't want any of his kids to know. I guess I don't know what he thought. For some reason, he didn't want us to know. But Jan and I, you know, the younger sister, the one that's in the program, it's been great. Me and her have had a great relationship growing up in AA, you know, and separating again and the whole family thing. So we go over and we visit him anyway. And because of this program, I was able to look in his eye and tell him that, you know, that was where I wanted to be. I chose, because he tried to tell me to leave, and I told him I respect that, I honor that, but this is where I'm going to be. I'm going to be with you. So he allowed me to be there for the next 6 months of his life until he passed away. That was a gift. You know, and the gift to my grandchildren. And then, you know, more good things that keep happening. I got married this past July, you know, again. I divorced I divorced that man I was married to after 5 years, when I was 5 years sober and in the nursing program. I left that relationship. I knew I no longer was going to be able to stay sober there. I left. We got divorced. He later died in an alcohol-related motor vehicle accident. But God, you know, he didn't close one door without opening another. And I met a man in AA who had been sober 2 years. And I met him at a dance. I was hosting a dance for our local intergroup. And he volunteered to make coffee, you know. And things just kind of went from there. He's still there. That was 6 years ago. We got married in July. We had an AA wedding. Everything's AA. You know, my kids know it. His kids know it. He has two kids, so I've got stepchildren too. But they don't live with me, but they are teenagers. So, we bought a house. Got out of that trailer park, you know. Not the drunk trailer park anymore. Got my own home, you know. That might not mean a lot, but it means a lot to me. It means a lot to me. Home is it's a feeling in my heart. It's not where I'm at. It's a feeling in my heart. I have a home today. You know, I have a home group and a sponsor, and I have a lot of friends, you know, friends like Buck and like Kathy, who called me this morning to tell me she loved me. And right before I came up here, she gave me something to really be grateful for. And my husband, thank you, Ken, for being here and being on the front row. He doesn't do front row well. You know, he likes to hang out in the back. I'd like to thank each and every one of you for being here. You're the reason that I'm here tonight. And thanks to the committee again for asking me to speak. Thanks for the speaker that went last night, Mike. And thanks for that. And Mike told me after the meeting, he said, you know, there's nothing as useless as an AA speaker who's already spoken. I like that, and I'm looking forward to being useless the rest of this weekend. Virginia Beach is beautiful in February, I guess, in any other month. And I'm going to close also with a promise from the big book that means a lot to me. It's on page, I think, 153. You know, and it says, and this is for all you people, you know, when I got here, I used to think, man, what am I going to do if I give up drinking? You know, what's out there? What is out there? You know, the big book tells us, you know, yes, there is a substitute. And it is vastly more than that. It's a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. Here you will find relief from boredom, care, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. Thank you.
This is for chaos.